From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We are waiting for a report on impeachment from House Democrats, which could come any minute now. Tonight, the House Intelligence Committee will vote on that report, which will summarize evidence gathered in the impeachment inquiry. Last night, Republicans released a lengthy prebuttal arguing that President Trump did nothing wrong when he asked the president of Ukraine to investigate political rival Joe Biden. NPR's Tim Mak is following it all and joins us from Washington. Hi, Tim.
Hey there.
And what is the Republican defense, first of all, and how did they refute the mountain of evidence that the Democrats have presented and all the testimony we heard from, in many cases, career Foreign Service officers who said, among other things, that there was a quid pro quo and it was ordered by the president?
Well, let's break it down, because there's one set of defenses for the conduct and another set of defenses regarding the testimony, right? So we've heard, it's become quite familiar to all of us who've been paying attention, some of these defenses from Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee during these hearings. They're arguing that the president has done nothing wrong, that the request he made for investigations into the Bidens or Burisma had nothing to do with benefiting him personally, but instead had to do with his genuine and reasonable skepticism of Ukraine due to corruption there. They're saying that his concerns about Hunter Biden are perfectly valid and legitimate. As for the testimony, I think the report that Republicans have put out is trying to discredit some of these witnesses. They argue that they're unelected bureaucrats who could not understand the president's quote-unquote outside-the-beltway approach to diplomacy. So they're saying that the impeachment inquiry did not yield firsthand evidence of a scheme to benefit the president himself.
We have, though, over the last couple of months, heard some Republicans say that what the president did in asking for help from the Ukrainians was not the right thing to do. Are they now all on the same page with this defense that he did nothing wrong?
Well, I don't think every single Republican has been unanimous with by saying that the president has done nothing wrong, right? Some Republicans continue to say that there was some misconduct here, but that it doesn't rise to the level of an impeachable offense. That's actually one of the reasons why later this week we'll see the House Judiciary Committee hold a hearing on what actually does constitute an impeachable offense. What action actually rises to that level?
And that hearing is happening in the House Judiciary Committee tomorrow. Meanwhile, Tim, last night, House Democrats released a video of highlights from the 2 weeks of public testimony, including from Trump appointee Ambassador to the EU Gordon Sondland. Take a listen.
Was there a quid pro quo with regard to the requested White House call and the White House meeting? The answer is yes. Everyone was in the loop. We followed the president's orders.
Tim, it sounds like Democrats are not in agreement on how wide in scope any impeachment articles should be.
Well, it's interesting. Democrats will be returning to Congress after Thanksgiving break this week, and we'll get a better sense from lawmakers as they come back and start talking to us reporters about where they stand exactly. I don't think that there is a tremendous amount of disagreement over how wide in scope the impeachment article should be. They're still discussing it. We haven't even gotten to the Judiciary Committee's starting its role in this process yet. And so we'll see what fissures, if any, might develop over the course of the next week.
By the way, the Judiciary Committee is holding their first hearing tomorrow. Do you expect more hearings in the coming weeks from either Judiciary or Intelligence Committee, or do we just not know at this point?
We just don't know. I mean, I think that both the House Judiciary Committee and the House Intelligence Committee have really been coy about saying being definitive about whether or not they're going to be holding additional hearings. They're open to the idea of additional information coming out or additional witnesses being ready to testify and being willing to testify in an open setting. So they don't want to say conclusively how that timeline is mm-hmm. going to happen or what meetings might occur.
In London this morning, President Trump dismissed talk that the House might censure him instead of impeaching him. Is that something Democrats are seriously discussing, and what would a censure mean?
Well, a censure would just mean a condemnation by the House or the House and the Senate saying that what the president did was wrong, that he had committed some misconduct. But it's also not an idea that's that, as far as I can tell, is seriously percolating through very large numbers of members. That in fact, you know, a lot of the folks who are pushing this idea of censure in terms of op-eds and newspapers and so forth are kind of moderate Republicans or opponents of the president who mm-hmm. are Republicans and are kind of looking for some way to find a compromise on this issue.
That is NPR's Tim Mak as we wait for the impeachment report from Democrats. Tim, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Well, it's always good to get a reminder that NATO stands for the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Our next guest says it's the most important treaty the U.S. is a member of, and it's fraying as the group marks its 70th birthday in London. President Trump has called NATO obsolete. Today, he repeated his criticism that other NATO countries should be spending more on defense, but he also had some words of support.
We're behind you 100%, and all of the money that's been raised and all of these countries that are all of a sudden putting up money, it's a great thing to see.
Meanwhile, he said that while sitting next to French President Macron, who's called NATO brain dead. Here in Now, security analyst Jim Walz is in the studio. He's with MIT's Security Studies Program. And Jim, so Trump applauding the countries who are paying more, that's been his biggest concern. Macron calling them brain dead for focusing too much on money and not on actual security. Your take on the tension here?
Well, I think we need to step back and look at where NATO is at. I would say it's at its lowest point probably since at least the end of the Cold War, maybe up through parts of the Cold War. And what you've seen this week with Macron's issuing statements that the president has criticized, that is the French pushing back and saying, well, if you're going to criticize us all the time, and if you're going to, you know, beat us up with sanctions and put tariffs on us and cozy up to Putin, then maybe we should think about doing something on our own, a European alternative to NATO. That's not going to happen. The Europeans are never going to do it. But it's symptomatic of the fact that this relationship is really rubbed raw. Yes, the NATO states are putting more money in. Yes, that's a good thing. But the most important thing at the end of the day for an alliance is the political commitment.
Yeah.
And if the leader of the United States of America is not fully committed to NATO, and which is what NATO members sense, then that alliance suffers.
Well, with good reason, because what Macron is angry about when you say you're going to do things by yourself, it's Trump's unilateral decision to pull troops out of Syria.
Yes, certainly there's that. I think there are a whole number of things that, you know, part of it is just I'd say there are three things going on that hurt NATO right now. One is the president's at best sort of ignoring NATO, at worst criticizing it. The other is President Erdogan of Turkey. Let's not downgrade that. The most problematic member of NATO, who now wants to use his interest in attacking the Kurds as leverage for bargaining within NATO on other topics like protecting Poland. And then finally, you have President Putin, who is just enjoying this to no end because his number one security objective is to divide and weaken NATO. And that's precisely what's happened.
Putin is enjoying a lot of things, no end, but we'll take that up elsewhere. You also have Turkey buying a Russian air defense system.
Yes.
So how does NATO handle Turkey?
Well, I'd also remind folks that NATO has tactical nuclear weapons in Turkey. And I can tell you in my community that is a topic of some discussion and the feeling that maybe this is reason enough to remove them. I think Erdogan, like President Trump, bold, impulsive actor, switches policies back and forth, is sensitive to criticism. And so the result has been he, too, has been a wild card on this. So he plays footsie with Russia on the S-400s, the defensive missile, yet wants NATO's help with the Kurds. And so he's just a problematic. He's among the most problematic members of NATO. And since NATO has a rule of consensus, everyone has to agree. You know, the larger NATO gets, the more difficult it is to get 100% of the parties to agree. That gives a lot of individual members leverage.
I want to ask you about, it just feels as if there is so much unrest around the world right now. Hong Kong, obviously, but Iran, Iraq. You know, we're not even getting a chance to report on some of this. Your thoughts on that?
There's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah.
I mean, and I would say you mentioned some of the good news. It's not always bad news. There's plenty of bad news. But there's some good news here. And when you see citizens rising up and pushing back in Iraq, in Iran, you could say in Catalonia, in Chile, in Sudan, and, you know, sometimes that's met with violence, but it is average citizens pushing back and demanding more of their governments. And when that's nonviolent on both sides, I think that is a real hopeful sign for some of these countries.
But what about when it's not? And your thoughts specifically on Iraq, Iran?
Well, Iraq is going to continue to be a difficult place to govern. I just think that's the way it is. There are deep divisions, right? You've got Sunni Kurd and Shias, and you've got corruption, and you've got a weak state. So I don't see that changing anytime soon.
Well, and it also just underscores where we started. NATO is so important.
You know, there's not, when I said before that it's the most important treaty that the U.S. is in, I say that because it's been the fundamental bedrock of the peace and prosperity that we have enjoyed since the end of World War II. And it's a treaty in which we commit our men and women, our soldiers, to die on the behalf of other countries as other countries do to us.
Article 5.
Article 5. And that's a really big commitment militarily. And that has to be matched with a really big commitment politically. And what we suffer today is the military commitment is there. People are spending more money. They're doing the training. They're writing the documents. It's the political commitment that seems to be missing.
Jim Walz, here now, security analyst, MIT Security Studies Program Fellow. Jim, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world, and when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news. We want to take another dive into our continuing series on climate, covering climate now, with a look in the mirror. What are you wearing? When we think of fossil fuel, we think of smokestacks and coal mines, not what's in your closet. But in fact, about 60% of synthetic fabrics are made of fossil fuels. And of those, 85% end up in landfills where they won't decay or decompose. And it's only getting worse because of fast fashion, those quickly and cheaply produced items that knock off the runway styles, sometimes so cheaply that they get thrown out after a single use. Think Primark or Zara. Carrie Summers is founder and global operations director of Fashion Revolution, an advocacy organization that, among other things, is addressing the environmental cost of fashion. She's outside London. And Carrie, this has become a big deal. Your organization is growing, you know, by leaps and bounds. Lucy, how many members do you have?
Oh, gosh, loosely. I know we had around 3.5 million people who engaged with Fashion Revolution over the course of last year. And since the Rana Plaza factory collapsed in Bangladesh 6 years ago, we've become the world's largest fashion activism movement.
Well, you mentioned this horrific factory collapse in Bangladesh where people realized these were, you know, largely young people who were making their clothing in horrific conditions. How many people died approximately?
It was 1,138 people who died, and around 2,500 people were injured.
That week in April every year is a Fashion Revolution week.
That's correct, with events all around the world, lots of events happening to show people that there's a better way to fill our wardrobes, but also to put pressure on those brands and retailers to really urgently start to clean up their acts and to do more to ensure that there's not human rights abuses and environmental degradation within their supply chains.
And talk about the environmental issues.
In many ways, the world's major fashion brands have played a huge part in accelerating climate change. I mean, for instance, the global fashion industry emits 1.7 billion tonnes of CO2 annually. That's more than the amount created by international flights and shipping. It's raw material, 60%. Around two-thirds of our clothing comes from synthetics. Synthetics are derived from fossil fuels. Turning them into materials is really carbon intensive. And when we look at what brands are doing in terms of the carbon footprint, we have an annual Fashion Transparency Index. We rank 200 of the world's largest fashion brands and retailers according to their level of transparency. And even though about 55% of brands are publishing their annual carbon footprint in their own sites, only 19.5% are disclosing their carbon emissions within the supply chain. And this is where over half of the industry's total emissions occur. It's been estimated that an 80% industry-wide emissions cut is needed by 2050 to align the industry's emissions with even a 2 degrees warming scenario. But at the moment, fashion's carbon emissions are projected to increase by more than 60% by 2030. So we've really got to see brands and retailers doing so much more.
Here's some of the examples you give. Polyester. It comes from fossil fuels, which contribute, of course, to global warming, but also shed those microfibers that are adding to levels of plastic in the ocean. Processing leather, so many chemicals that are added to the tan hides, that goes into the environment. It's textile waste. And fast fashion particularly adds to this problem because these are such cheap articles. They may look great. They may look like something you saw on the runway. They're great knockoffs. But you throw them away because they don't last.
Exactly. I mean, like you said, they're being made from very cheap synthetic materials. And in our index, we found that only 15% of brands have any kind of time-bound measurable goal to actually reduce their use of virgin plastics. And there's around 150 billion new items of clothing which are being put on the market every year. And estimates are saying that around 25% of that clothing remains unworn. So really what we need to do is to care for our clothes. We need to make them last longer. And even extending the life of our garments by an extra 9 months of active use would reduce the carbon, water and waste footprint by around 20 to 30% each.
One of the things that was so disturbing to read, it's all disturbing, but we had gone to faux fur as a protection of animals, but also hoping that that was using less chemicals. But we understand now that people discovered that faux fur was not as cheap as, let's say, cat fur. So a lot of the things that people think are faux fur are actually things like cat fur?
Yes, I mean, we have seen faux fur coats which are being made from real fur. But at the same time, I mean, whoever thought faux fur was a good idea? Faux fur is made from synthetics. It's all microfibers. And it's estimated that a faux fur coat would take around 1,000 years to break apart in landfill. I'm not going to say degrade or break down because it never disappears. These are just going to reduce into smaller and smaller and smaller pieces of plastic. All of those plastics are going to the oceans and they're killing fish, they're destroying our ecosystems and probably, you know, killing more species than the fur coats that they are intended to replace.
Well, so you are also coming up with solutions and there are all sorts of campaigns. Make It Last is one. Stella McCartney has really been at the forefront of this. Buy fewer things, better quality, keep it longer.
Yes, no, that's absolutely right. We need to be keeping our clothes for longer. We've been involved in this cycle where we buy and discard and we buy and discard too fast, unsustainably. Estimated that in North America, 10.5 million tonnes of clothing are sent to landfill every year. That's about 30 times as heavy as the Empire State Building. And even when we're sending our clothes to charity shops, to recycle, to thrift stores, then a lot of this clothing is getting sent to sub-Saharan Africa, to Central America, to Latin America, and it's destroying the local textile and tailoring economies there. So we're going to have to start to deal with our own waste clothing. I mean, as you said, there's fantastic ways to get new clothes without buying new. So we can hire, we can rent, we can swap. Or we can, you know, invest in clothes which are made by artisans, which have taken time and skill to produce.
Well, in her new book, Fashionopolis, Dana Thomas talks about designers who are producing sustainably. I mentioned Stella McCartney. There's also Natalie Chainin. She has a business called Alabama Chainin and sells clothing that's sustainable, local, from cotton that's grown there. Greenpeace is pressuring brands to remove dangerous chemicals from their supply chains through the Detox the Catwalk campaign. But Carrie Summers, I can hear particularly young people saying, well, wait a second, it's easy for some of you who've been working for a couple of decades and maybe have a steady income to go out and buy that one lovely thing that's more expensive that you'll wear for the rest of your life. I can't. I don't have an income. And in the first time in history, really, I can afford things that look like designer things, even though they're cheap. Why should I give that up? I mean, how do you argue that?
Well, basic ethical standards actually shouldn't cost that much more. When you buy a garment, the cost of the labour is typically between 1 and 3%. We did a cost breakdown of a 29 euro t-shirt, and the labour cost was 18 cents paying a fair living wage would bring that labour cost up to 45 cents. So really, that's such a small difference. We were part of a survey 2 years ago of 540 garment workers in Cambodia, India and Bangladesh. 40% of the workers in Bangladesh had seen a fire in their place of work. People are still taking risks every day to make our clothes. Women are subject to violence, to abuse. 5% of the workers we talked to had been hit. And we really have to see brands doing so much more.
You've been to Bangladesh. What have you seen?
Yes, I mean, 2 years ago, I visited the garment factories and the tanneries in Bangladesh. I saw young underage workers there with no health and safety equipment at all, barefooted on top of the pile of hides containing toxic chemicals. I saw the effluent flowing out of the facilities into the drainage ditches and out into the local Delishwari River, which is home to the red-listed river dolphin. And I was told that no brand ever goes to visit the tanneries. You know, this is something we found in our Fashion Transparency Index. Only 38 out of the 200 brands are disclosing their processing facilities. So this is where the tanning takes place, as well as ginning, spinning, printing, dyeing. And only 10 brands are disclosing the facilities or farms supplying some of their fibres. And we know that the further down the supply chain, the more we're likely to see environmental abuses. We know that a lot of the human rights abuses, like modern slavery and forced labour, exploitation thrives in hidden places.
Do you think that, as some are saying, maybe it is millennials who might have benefited from this, being the younger people who are buying from some of these chains, who are now turning their backs on them? Do you see some hope?
Yes, I certainly do see hope. The fashion resale market is expected to be bigger than the fast fashion market within the next decade. We've seen it growing 21 times faster than fast fashion in the last 3 years. And we've seen such a difference, even in the last 12 months. So we can ask the brands that we love the question, who made my clothes? What are they doing to address the concrete measures which are of interest to us? Once they receive a certain number of messages, typically between about 50 and 200 on a certain issue, that will immediately get escalated to board level for further discussion.
That's Carrie Summers, founder and global operations director of Fashion Revolution. Carrie, thank you.
Thank you.
Today, the French finance minister, Bruno Le Maire, said that if President Trump imposes tariffs on French products as threatened, the EU will retaliate. Trump is threatening tariffs in response to a tax France is levying on some U.S. tech firms, including Google and Amazon. And this spat comes as both countries air their competing visions for NATO at the NATO meeting this week in London. But it's not just France. Earlier this week, Trump announced new tariffs on some products from Brazil and Argentina, and he's signaling that he might wait longer for a trade agreement with China, to which the markets responded by dropping. Ali Velshi is the MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Robin.
And start with France, Trump threatening a 100% tariff on wine and other luxury goods in retaliation for France's new digital tax. What's that about?
So France levied a 3% tax on companies that have at least $845 million in global revenue who do online sales in France, but are not based in France. There are about 30 companies affected by this, and most of them are American tech firms like Google and Facebook. There's some Chinese and British, and even some French businesses affected. But it's part of a global push where countries are trying to deal with the fact that tax codes are not written for the internet. So what do you do with a company that's based in a low tax haven or a place that they're paying their taxes to, but they make a lot of money in your country? A digital tax is a solution seen by some companies, but because most of these big digital companies are American, America doesn't tend to like this.
Well, and it's interesting because internally, within the country, there's concern that people are buying things online and not paying taxes on them. So we have that question here as well. But here is President Trump really kind of lashing out at these countries. Many other countries doing this, Turkey, Italy. Trump said they could be next in line for a tariff hike. And one of the rationales for the tariffs we're hearing this week is currency manipulation. Trump announced those new steel and aluminum tariffs on Argentina and Brazil. Because, as he said, they're currency manipulators. But we know Brazil's also stepped in to supply soybeans to China, because China stopped buying them from the U.S. because of the trade war. So
yes.
What's going on here?
So it's hard to call Brazil or Argentina currency manipulators. In fact, the United States Treasury, which does this on an official basis, doesn't contain either of those two countries. The real and the peso are down because both of those countries' economies are very weak. Brazil is on the edge of a recession. Argentina is dealing with a bunch of things, including 50% inflation. So that's typically what this is all about. Brazil's got a free floating currency. So if your economy is weak, typically you lower your interest rates. And when you lower interest rates, your currency becomes less attractive to other countries. Now, Brazil and Argentina have been selling U.S. dollars to support their and buying their currencies on the open market to support them. That's actually the opposite of currency manipulation. When you buy dollars and strengthen the U.S. dollar, that is currency manipulation against the dollar. So Donald Trump's ideas about currency manipulation don't make sense. But Brazil got most of the soybean orders that used to come from America after the trade deal. Yeah. And so and we're not, even if the trade deal were dropped tomorrow, China has helped Brazil build some of that infrastructure to supply soybeans, so they're going to be doing a lot more business with China. So that is part of it.
Could
it's got
be
more to
payback,
do with the trade deal.
Payback there. Just real brief, we only got 30 seconds.
Yeah.
What do you think about that trade deal?
Well, a lot of people have been doubting whether one's coming. President Trump keeps on hinting it's around the corner. We're going to have the signing. And now he's saying it may not happen until after the election, which is in keeping with what we've been hearing from the Chinese. So that's why markets are suffering today. No deal on the horizon.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor, economics correspondent, and our friend. Thank you.
Thank you.
There is a new book out today about Brett Kavanaugh, the newest Supreme Court justice, whose confirmation hearings became a bitter political fight. Sexual assault allegations against Kavanaugh and emotional testimony by Christine Blasey Ford threatened to derail the nomination, but Kavanaugh fought back.
This whole two-week effort has been a calculated and orchestrated political hit, fueled with apparent pent-up anger about President Trump and the 2016 election, fear that has been unfairly stoked about my judicial record, revenge on behalf of the Clintons, and millions of dollars in money from outside left-wing opposition groups. This is a circus.
In the end, Kavanaugh was confirmed in the Senate by a vote of 50-48. Kavanaugh replaced the court's swing justice, Anthony Kennedy, and cemented the conservative majority on the high court. The details and drama behind the Kavanaugh nomination are laid out in Ruth Marcus's new book, Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. She's a columnist for The Washington Post and joins us from Washington. Ruth Marcus, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
President Trump famously had a list of people he said he would nominate to the Supreme Court. And originally, Brett Kavanaugh was not on that list. How did he get on that list?
So that is a great question. Brett Kavanaugh was not on three lists. Social conservatives were very wary of President Trump. Social conservatives and evangelical voters, one of their most motivating factors is the Supreme Court. So the combination of a Supreme Court vacancy and having President Trump or then candidate Trump do this unprecedented thing of telling people, okay, here are the nominees I'm going to select, and I'm going to select only from these nominees, gave them the comfort to go ahead and vote for this guy who, after all, had been a Democrat, had been married three times, was a New York liberal, etc. But Brett Kavanaugh was not on, first of all, the list that Leonard Leo, executive vice president of the Federalist Society, presented to then-candidate Trump in March of 2016. Then-candidate Trump comes out with his first list in May of 2016, no Brett Kavanaugh. He comes out with his second list in the fall of 2016, no Brett Kavanaugh. This didn't seem to be a big deal if you were Brett Kavanaugh, because it wasn't very likely, after all, that candidate Trump was going to become President Trump. But then he became president and he was elected. And Brett Kavanaugh, whose, pardon the phrase, supreme ambition had been to get on the Supreme Court for quite a while, had a problem, which was he was not on the list that the president had promised to choose from. And so a whole group of Kavanaugh allies and supporters, and he had a lot of them because he had spent a good deal of time in Washington. He had gotten incredible support for everybody from President Bush, who he had worked for, for Justice Kennedy, who he had clerked for. And people went to work on Brett Kavanaugh's behalf. Among them was Justice Kennedy, who in a private meeting with the president said, hey, there's a guy who's not on your list and he should be. And when Justice Kennedy talked, President Trump listened because President Trump really wanted to do everything he could to encourage Justice Kennedy to step down.
So how early did Kennedy go to Trump and say you should think about Kavanaugh on the court?
So nobody knew about this at the time, but it was at the swearing in for Justice Neil Gorsuch that Justice Kennedy asked for some time alone with the president. He made this suggestion. A few months later, lo and behold, Brett Kavanaugh ends up on a new expanded improved list. And the reason that it was so hard for him to get on the list was twofold. From President Trump's point of view, Brett Kavanaugh was a Bushie. He had not only worked for President George W. Bush, he had married the president's secretary. So this was not a guy that was likely to appeal to President Trump. And there was also among some conservatives some doubts about whether Justice Kavanaugh would be conservative enough for them.
But you say that Kennedy actually, when he hand-delivered his resignation or his retirement letter to President Trump, he said Kavanaugh again.
Yes. He said Kavanaugh and perhaps one other judge who had also clerked for Kennedy, Judge Kethledge. There's a little bit of disputed evidence on that. But Justice Kennedy was very, very fond of Brett Kavanaugh. He would tell his clerks, oh, this is where Brett sat. Oh, Brett worked the longest hours. And like many of us, he has some ego. And the notion of being succeeded by his own favorite clerk really, really appealed to him.
But isn't Kavanaugh quite a different justice than Justice Kennedy? I mean, a lot of people think of Justice Kennedy as the famous sort of center of the court, the one who sided with the liberals in some cases, like on same-sex marriage.
Sure. Well, Justice Kennedy very famously and most importantly on issues relating to gay rights and eventually in the creation of an announcement of a constitutional right to same-sex marriage had those tendencies. He was overall, though, a quite conservative justice, even though he was at the center of this quite conservative court. But there was no way, and I think Justice Kennedy understood that, that any Republican president in the current environment was going to name another Justice Kennedy. What I talk about in the book is how the Kavanaugh nomination is really the result of 30 years of judicial nomination wars and 30 years of a learning curve by the conservative legal establishment and conservative operatives to understand they're not going to make another mistake. They got Kennedy only because they lost Judge Bork, who was nominated in 1987.
And then
then he was borked. Kennedy was a much more moderate person. Conservatives vowed to themselves after that that they were not going to lose another confirmation battle, and they didn't. Then after that happened, we had nominees like Justice Souter, who was nominated by George H.W. Bush, turned out to be quite a liberal justice, not the home run for conservatives that the president had promised. And the rallying cry there was no more Souters. So there was no chance when Justice Kennedy retired that we were going to get a Kennedy-like replacement. He was always going to be whoever replaced him, and this is true of Justice Kavanaugh, much more like Justice Scalia, much more like Chief Justice Rehnquist or Chief Justice Roberts than like a Kennedy figure.
We, of course, remember in Kavanaugh's confirmation hearings on the day when he had to respond to allegations from Christine Blasey Ford about sexual assault, that he went on a tirade against the accusations and railed against the Democrats and even the Clintons by name. Now, he did work under Kenneth Starr in the investigation into the Clintons. And you've got a memo, or part of a memo in this book, that Kavanaugh wrote to Starr in 1998 saying the president has disgraced his office. He's talking about President Clinton, the legal system and the American people by having sex with a 22-year-old intern and turning her life into a shambles. It may not be our job to impose sanctions on him, but it is our job to make his pattern of revolting behavior clear, piece by painful piece. Tell me about Kavanaugh and the Clintons and why he had such animosity towards the Clintons from that moment all the way through to the hearings to get onto the Supreme Court.
That was really both a remarkable memo, and it was a remarkable moment when he invoked the Clintons in that tirade that you were mentioning that we were all mesmerized by. And by the way, that was not an off-the-cuff remark. The day before, as he was preparing his opening statement, Judge Kavanaugh went into his chambers closeted with one clerk who had been a speechwriter and rewrote his opening statement and made it much more vitriolic, much more partisan, to the point where he came out and looked at his lawyers who were kind of liberal Democrats, the private lawyers he hired, and he said, "You're not going to like some of this." He knew what he was doing. I think that it was the Star experience where Star's prosecutors were in this very pitched litigation with the Clintons. There was a lot of argument about whether, obviously, the president was telling the truth and about the content of his behavior. And it wasn't just in that memo that Brett Kavanaugh expressed this hostility towards the Clintons. I tell one story in the book about going out on a blind date with somebody. This is during the Star period. He started railing about the Clintons to her, even though he didn't know her and she was an assistant U.S. attorney. He kind of knew she was a Democrat. But he surprised his friends by the vitriol that he had towards the Clintons then, and obviously it persisted.
How about some good news? How about an endangered bird making a recovery? The red-cockaded woodpecker lives mostly in southeastern U.S., and it's been on the endangered species list for almost 50 years. But now it's doing well enough that there's been talk of downgrading its protections. But as Molly Samuel of member station WABE reports, there are concerns that this little bird isn't ready.
It's still dark out when wildlife researchers at Fort Stewart, Georgia, start their day. Crickets and frogs chirp in the muggy early morning. The mosquitoes are terrible. The researchers are here to catch a few woodpeckers, to tag them. Wildlife technician Josh Wimberly says they creep up to the trees to catch the birds as they wake up.
I find they're like people. Some of them sleep hard, some of them are very light.
Fort Stewart, near Savannah, is the largest Army installation east of the Mississippi. It's also home to a large population of red-cockaded woodpeckers living in its longleaf pine forest. The bird used to be pretty common, but has been endangered for decades.
Actually, they were considered endangered before the Endangered Species Act was passed.
Larry Carlisle is a wildlife biologist at Fort Stewart. He says the red-cockaded woodpecker was one of the first species to be listed as endangered. The woods they live in, the longleaf pine forests of the southeast, were rapidly disappearing because of logging, development, and wildfire suppression.
People recognize that if we lost all of our mature longleaf forests, then we'd lose the red-cockaded woodpecker along with it.
Carlisle watches as Wimberly heads quietly into the woods to catch a woodpecker.
And so he's just putting a net that's mounted on a telescoping pole up over the cavity.
The cavity is the hole where the woodpecker is sleeping. Each bird has its own cavity in its own tree.
Oh, he's got one already?
Fort Stewart has done a good job helping bring these woodpeckers back. The numbers here are actually high enough that they catch red-cockaded woodpeckers here at Fort Stewart and move them to other places that need help building up their populations of the endangered birds. The researchers put ID bands on the birds they've caught.
This is a hatch year male, as you can see by the dot on the top of his head.
These are tiny little black and white woodpeckers. The adult males have red feathers on the sides of their heads. That's the red cockade that their name refers to. The young bird pecks Wimberly's hands between its squawks.
That's typical. You're feisty this morning.
So what's gone right at Fort Stewart? It's something that works across their range. Red-cockaded woodpeckers need two things, fire and artificial cavities. Fire, because that's what mature longleaf pine forests need to stay healthy. Artificial cavities, because right now there still aren't enough old pine trees for the woodpeckers to make their own cavities. So humans have to help by making special birdhouses for them. Larry Carlisle.
It's not rocket science. We've known what the bird requires for a long time. All you got to do is do it.
Across most of its range, at this point, the woodpecker's recovery is seen as a success. That's according to Jeff Walters. He's a behavioral ecologist at Virginia Tech.
People started bringing fire back. The artificial cavities happened. And now all of the major populations pretty much have increased.
Now the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is considering changing the status of the red-cockaded woodpecker from endangered down to threatened, or maybe even taking it off the list entirely. The agency wouldn't consent to an interview for this story, but sent a statement that partially says, quote, "The fact that we were able to consider reclassifying the woodpecker is a major accomplishment for conservation." And while it is an accomplishment, some are concerned that changing the woodpecker status now is a bad idea.
The red-cockaded woodpecker is still working on recovering. It's still being managed.
Ramona McGee is an attorney at the Southern Environmental Law Center. She says the woodpeckers can't survive without those two important things, controlled burns and artificial cavities.
It's still reliant on those conservation measures that the Fish and Wildlife Service, state agencies, the military, all these stakeholders have been doing for years.
McGee says she's concerned about switching the bird from endangered to threatened. That's because the Trump administration has changed regulations related to the Endangered Species Act, including changes to threatened species that, going forward, could leave the birds less protected. McGee also says if the federal government stops protecting the birds, some states, including Georgia, say they can't afford to keep up conservation measures long term.
The states are strapped for money, and they don't have the resources to do the sort of management that's required for red-cockaded woodpeckers on their own.
A spokesman for Fish and Wildlife says many of the agency's partners have said they will keep doing the things the birds need. Later in the morning at Fort Stewart, wildlife technician Ryan Adamson prepares to climb a tree to insert one of those artificial cavities.
I'm going to use a chainsaw to cut a cube out of the tree and replace it with an artificial bird box.
At Fort Stewart, they will continue burning, no matter what happens to the woodpecker status, keeping the forest healthy with prescribed fires, good for troop training, too. And they'll continue inserting cavities as long as the Army installation's natural resources plan calls for it. Once he's done with the artificial cavity and back down on the ground, Adamson and the other wildlife technicians laugh that they're building government housing for woodpeckers.
Yeah, they're kind of spoiled out here.
Scientists, including Jeff Walters, say they could live with the woodpecker being downlisted to threatened, but only if humans keep helping. If not,
we'll be right back where we started from.
Walter says a lot of people see red-cockaded woodpeckers as a big conservation success story, and it would be a shame for it to have a bad ending. For Here and Now, I'm Molly Samuel.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now. We'll have the latest on the impeachment hearings in the House Judiciary Committee.
And we'll dig into the two reports on impeachment, one in favor by the Democrats, one in defense of the president, that's from Republicans.
All that and the latest from Wall Street as investors worry about trade tensions. That's next time on Here and Now.